Welcome to the Hatbury House of Chosun. My name is Bob, and reading today from Scarlet Threads, Part 2, where we move from pagan Rome to papal Rome. Now, I hope you followed me so far. This is not something that you'd want to just start out with right now. You want to go back and check out Part 1, where we traced Babylon from its ancient beginnings of the Tower of Babel through Babylonia, through Neo-Babylonia, and then those mysteries that moved on to Assyria and to Medo-Persia and to Greece and to Rome. But it didn't stop right there. Babylon is going to continue to the very end of time, and so we've got to identify her still. I'm dedicating part two to those, to the true church of Jesus that has come out of Babylon once for all. And that's what we are called to do, to come out of her and be separate. So part two, it's called, as I said, Rome, pagan to papal. And the time frame would be from A.D. 100 to A.D. 1300 that we will cover in this little booklet. First one was all the way from 4000 B.C. to right now, A.D. 100. Introduction to part two, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, Ephesians 6:12. It is not men to whom we look as we seek the origin of the conspiracy against Christ and his church. We worry not whether mere mortals were aware of the part they played in the unfolding drama. We look behind the scenes to view the master conspirator and to expose him. It is Lucifer who is behind the priesthoods of men. He's the one whose earthly throne always contains a chief priest or Pontifex Maximus, the offerer of the sacrifice. It is his lust for power and glory that infiltrates men and causes them to rise to the top. Jesus has always called his own to be his love slaves. Worldly power is not their goal at all. Wherever this earthbound, Satan-directed supreme pontiff sits can be labeled Babylon. We ask not whether the man is good. Many of them have been good by human standards. We ask not whether they may or may not be possessors of certain acceptable doctrines. Of course they speak truth at times. No, we ask if he sits in Satan's seat, and that seat is Babylon. Judge for yourself the progression of the following events. Now, we hasten to add that there is a true priesthood among us also. And the true high priest sits in the heavenlies, making intercession for his own constantly. He's offered the only important sacrifice, himself. And he's the only one worthy to bear the title Pontifex Maximus. All others must certainly be frauds and impostors, whether ignorantly or not. They need to step aside, and one day they shall. They'll be forced aside. Here then is the sad story of how Christ's pure and holy people were approached by and enticed by a very attractive lady. You can call her the love of power. You can call her the need for importance. Call her what you will. The Bible calls her Babylon. We're talking now about the early church in A.D. 30. During and following the days of the foundational writers, the church is new and strong and freshly filled with the Holy Ghost. False teachings abound, but what a church is forming. Here's a brief sketch of that church as a backdrop against which the other church can be set for your later comparison. Whatever your present affiliation, it will be difficult to compare it favorably to those first days of the church. The first Christians have all things in common. They're not forced, all voluntary. They meet daily in various homes or existing buildings or special hiding places to keep themselves safe from the Babylon of that day, pagan Rome. No church buildings, No air conditioning. No loudspeaker systems. No mics. There's a simplicity about their meetings which varies from town to town, but has the same basic elements, inspired by the same Spirit, and recorded by Luke in the book of Acts and Paul in his epistles. And so I've outlined a couple of things. Number one, the teaching of the apostles. Number two, they had the prayers. Three, there was worship. Four, manifestations of the Spirit of God. Five, the breaking of the bread or the Lord's Supper. And six, often fellowship dinners or love feasts were a part of the meeting. They soon became a problem and had to be eliminated. And the Lord keeps adding to the church those who are being set free from sin, that is, saved. Great grace is upon them. Now, to see an involved pagan ritual in the days of old pagan Rome, and then to see a simple meeting of God's people, is to see two totally different events, not even close to comparison. At least in the beginning, no one could compare Christianity to paganism. But things change. In their personal lives and in their communal life, the early Christians are a separated people. They use the world as needed, but they keep their eyes on the heavens once they look for Christ to return at any moment. People such as the above described have their descendants among us today, simple men and women, children too, who want nothing but the Word of God, the Spirit of God, the people of God, and a God-given job to do while waiting for Jesus' return. But slowly, another people evolve. Things are added. Things are subtracted. An evolution takes place. A mixing of good and evil, which always produces evil. Now, Edward Gibbon, the author of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, he's not known to be a defender of the faith. In fact, one could easily label him a cynic, as he closely views the growing church of antiquity and grows sick watching. But his candid comments, I think, are worth hearing as he traces this development. I'm on page 376 of his work, Volume 1. The primitive Christians, he says, were dead to the business and pleasure of the world, but their love of action soon revived and found a new occupation in the government of the church. The ambition of raising themselves or their friends to the honors and offices of the church was disguised by the laudable intention of devoting to the public benefit the power and consideration which, for that purpose only, it became their duty to solicit. And while they concealed from others, and perhaps from themselves, the secret motives of their conduct, they too frequently relapsed into all the turbulent passions of active life. The government of the church, he says, has often been the subject, as well as the prize, of religious contention. The hostile disputants of Rome struggled to reduce the primitive and apostolic model to the respective standards of their own policy. Let's talk more about church government. I'm still quoting from Gibbon here. The public functions of religion were solely entrusted to the established ministers of the church, the bishops and presbyters, elders, and leaders. Two appellations, two names, titles, which in their first origin appear to have distinguished the same office, bishops and presbyters, that's right, and the same order of persons. The order of public deliberation soon introduces the office of a president. The lofty title of bishop began to raise itself above the humble title of presbyter. This episcopal form of government appears to have been introduced before the end of the first century. It is still revered as a primitive and even as a divine establishment. It is needless to observe that the pious and humble presbyters, the elders, who were first dignified with the episcopal title, bishop, could not possess and would probably have rejected the power and pomp which now encircles the tiara of the Roman pontiff. End of quote. But he goes on again here as to their general situation in the Roman world. The Christian world was not yet connected by any supreme authority or legislative assembly. They discovered the advantages that might result from a closer union. And towards the end of the second century, the churches of Greece and Asia adopted provincial synods borrowed from the model of a representative council of their own country. Bishops of the independent churches should meet in the capital of the province. Their decrees were styled canons, C-A-N-O-N. The Catholic Church soon assumed the form and acquired the strength of a great federative republic. Things keep changing, he says. I'm quoting again. The prelates of the 3rd century imperceptibly changed the language of exhortation into that of command. It was said that the episcopal or bishop authority alone was derived from the deity and extended itself over this and over another world. The bishops were the vice regents of Christ, the successors of the apostles, and the mystic substitutes of the high priest of the Mosaic law, as if the shepherd had been of a more exalted nature than that of his sheep. The inferior clergy, when in opposition, received the ignominious epithets of faction and schism. Prelates soon acquired the lofty titles of metropolitans and primates and secretly prepared themselves to usurp over their episcopal brethren the same authority which the bishops had so lately assumed above the college of presbyters. Soon they were playing king of the mountain, in my words, but let's move on with Gibbon. Each of them affecting to display in the most pompous terms the temporal honors and advantages of the city over which he presided. The numbers and opulence of the Christians who were subject to their pastoral care, the saints and martyrs who had arisen among them, and the purity with which they preserved the tradition of the faith. It was easy to foresee that Rome must enjoy the respect and would soon claim the obedience of the provinces. The Roman Church was the greatest, the most numerous, and so on, ad nauseum. But note these digressions, finally, again from Gibbon. One more thing, the progress of the ecclesiastical authority gave birth to the memorable distinction of laity and clergy, which had been unknown to the Greeks and Romans. The former of these titles comprehended the body of the Christian people. The latter, according to the signification of the word, was appropriated to the chosen portion that had been set apart for the service of religion, a celebrated order of men, which has furnished the most important, though not always the most edifying, subjects for modern history. Their mutual hostilities sometimes disturbed the peace of the infant church, but their zeal and activity were united in the common cause, and the love of power, which under the most artful disguises could insinuate itself into the breasts of bishops and martyrs, animated them to increase the number of their subjects and to enlarge the limits of the Christian empire. The community of goods was adopted for a short time in the primitive church. The progress of the Christian religion relaxed, and gradually abolished this generous institution, which in hands less pure than those of the apostles would too soon have been corrupted and abused. You see what he said there? They were gathering money together to give to the poor. That's what they did in the early church. They bring all their stuff to the apostles. The apostles would distribute it. But there's such corruption in the church now. You don't want to have an institution like that. It was starting to go down already. And when paganism is finally admitted to the church by law of the Caesars, most people didn't seem to care. This new breed gives to us the line of descent that we can only call Babylonian. The people of Babylon, whether old or new Babylon, can never feel at home with the people of Jerusalem, whether old or new Jerusalem. The harlot church can never accept the people who know their God through Jesus Christ. And the true Jew of the old covenant, or the true Christian of the new, is bound always to expose this harlotry. And that's what we do here. I think that's all we'll take time for today. I would like to share with you, though, a book. And I've been doing this every day, just about. The book of the day that you might be interested in following up on. Not about the scarlet threads, but about other things that I've written. So let's look at the book of the day for today. All right, that book is A Christian View of Islam, Muhammad, and the Quran. Now you say, we already had that one. No, this is what I've done is I've taken that book on the Quran that I wrote and the book on Muhammad that I wrote, comparing him to Jesus and comparing the Quran to the Bible, put those into one book if you want to get both of them together. A Christian View of Islam, Muhammad, and the Quran contains a short description of Islam, a tour of the Quran, and compares the Quran to the Christian Bible, and a similar comparison of Muhammad to Christ. It's ideal for those who want to be informed about Islam in an introductory way. We don't go super, super deep, but I think you'll find it very helpful if you're just beginning in this study. That's available at Amazon.com. A Christian View of Islam, Muhammad, and the Quran. Or you can click right there at Sermon Audio. You can just click on Store and look that title up. Okay, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for being here. We're going to be back, Lord willing, next time with more of Scarlet Threads and the evils that we are finding in Babylon. The mystery the Bible calls Babylon. Okay, God bless you. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun, and Lord willing, we will talk soon. Bye-bye.